I want to speak about a few topics if we have time, and I want to start with a general introduction to the 10 trials of Avraham Avinu, the Asara Nisyonos, and something that Reb Chaim Volozhiner says in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, Ruach Chaim. He says that each of these tests that Avraham Avinu passed created reservoirs of power that the Jewish people can tap throughout the generations. Therefore, he says that if Avraham Avinu had not been willing to sacrifice his son Yitzchak, then no Jew throughout history could ever have been Moser Nefesh, given up his life for the life of his family, Al Kiddush Hashem. Because otherwise, Avraham Avinu was willing to sacrifice his son. Thousands, millions of Jews were willing to do similar things throughout history. Gave up their lives of their family. So what's the big deal? So he says the big deal was that if Avraham Avinu had not initiated this, then throughout history no one would have had the power to do it. We cull the power, we tap the power from the reservoir that Avraham Avinu created. Now, on the surface, I have a question on that. And that is, it's not only Jews who are able to give their lives for causes they believe in, to give their lives for the Ribbono Shel Olam, but Goyim also give their lives for their Avodah Zarah L'Havdil, for causes. People die for communism or for whatever. Right? Buddhist monks immolate themselves and give their lives for what they believe in. So without Avraham Avinu, we couldn't have done it, but they can do it without Avraham Avinu? Or Avraham Avinu helped for them too? How does it work? Why is it that no Jew in history could have done what Goyim do? The answer, I think, is the following. And I'll give you another question that I answered with this idea, and it applies here too. When I was a rabbi in Miami many years ago, so my shul was relatively a quiet shul, okay? Not as quiet as the shul I have now in Eretz Israel, because in America, shuls are known, especially religious shuls, and the more religious, the more noisy. And I once had a guest in the shul, and the guest was not a shomer mitzvah. He was there for simcha. And he usually davened, I don't remember, either in a conservative temple or reformed temple. And he came to me after davening and he said, Rabbi, I don't understand. You people are religious people. Okay. And in my conservative temple or my reformed temple, you can hear a pin drop during the services. There's respect and decorum. Nobody's walking around. Nobody's talking. And in your synagogue, it's not like that. There are people walking around, some people talking, and again, it was relatively a very quiet and well-decorum shul, comparative. I was once in a shul. I had to speak in New York, in a certain neighborhood, which I won't mention where it is, because it's clearly Lashon Hara. I had to speak in three shuls Shabbos morning. So I davened Shachris in one shul and spoke after Shachris before Kriya Satorah in that shul. I left to the second shul and made Kriya Satorah in that shul and spoke after Kriya Satorah before Musaf, then went to the third shul for Musaf and spoke after Musaf. The second shul that I came to, so I come to the shul and there is pandemonium. I mean, not people talking. They are yelling at the top of their lungs to each other. I thought Chas v'Shalom had been a pigur. I pushed my way to the front of the shul and I found out they were laning. Except not too many people were aware of it, because about 10 people around the bima were listening to the laning. Everybody else was shouting so they could be heard above the noise that other people were making. That's how bad it was. So here's this question that the man asked me. He said, you know, you're supposedly more religious than us, yet we have more decorum in our temple than you have in your shul. So my balabatim used to answer that question with, yes, Rabbi, they don't feel at home in their temples. They go to a show. You go to the opera, you keep quiet. Right? So they go to hear a show, and we feel at home in our shul. And therefore we act tamer. I said, it's not a good answer, because there's a very big difference between Hamish and Behamish. Hamish is one thing, but you wouldn't do this in your living room. So don't tell me it's Hamish. So that's not a good answer. So I think the answer is, I didn't tell that person this answer. It wasn't for him. But I think the answer is the following. That is exactly the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara wants you to treat a place that has no holiness. Conservative temple, where men and women sit together, a Reformed temple, which is even worse. I once attended a Reformed Friday night service when I was a kid. They had some kind of simcha there, and I dropped in Friday night. And they said Shema Yisrael. I didn't recognize it. Instead of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, their version was Shema Yisrael, Yisrael, Ameinu, Yisrael Echad. They just took God out of the Shema Yisrael. So, these places have no holiness, no Kiddush. The Yetzer Hara wants you to treat them as if they do have holiness. That is the Yetzer Hara. And a place that has holiness, the Yetzer Hara wants to treat it as if it doesn't have holiness. It's exactly the Yetzer Hara. I'll tell you something else. How this Yetzer Hara works in such a an interestingly contradictory way. There are many, let's call them modern schools, okay, day schools, where they have a problem of teaching Gemara to the boys as part of the curriculum, or making it a significant part of the curriculum, because they say Gemara is irrelevant. What in the world is it necessary to learn about somebody's ox goring somebody else's ox? Irrelevant to these kids. So they minimize the study of Gemara and they maximize other studies. That's more or less a modern day school philosophy. Yet those same day schools have to teach Gemara to girls. If you already have a problem teaching Gemara to boys that have to learn Gemara, then why don't you feel free to not ever speak about Gemara to a girl because it's so irrelevant? But no, the girl, where there's no mitzvah to do it, that's where you want to do it. And when there's a mitzvah to do it, that's where you don't want to do it. That's the Yetzer Hara. Same thing over here. For an idolater to give his life for his idolatry, the Yetzer Hara is 100% for. Doesn't put up any fight. You can do it without any extra help. But for a Jew to give up his life for the Rabbanu Shalom, you need all the power of Avraham Avinu to fight the Yetzer Hara, because if you didn't have that power, you wouldn't be able to do it. I think that's a legitimate answer. Okay, in any case, that brings me to the next point. If that's the case, then any Jew in history that ever was able to move from Chutz Laretz, from familiar surroundings, family, friends, and make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, as many of you have done, got the power to do it from the Nisayon of Lech Lecha. One of the 10 trials of Avraham Avinu was leave your birthplace, your land, your father's home, come go to Eretz Yisrael. Avraham Avinu was able to do that. He created the wellsprings, a reservoir of power for all Jews to call upon, to tap throughout history to do similar things. So therefore I think it's a good idea for us to understand what the test of Lech Lecha is, what Avraham Avinu had to do, so we'll understand better what we need to tap to be able to do it properly. First question is, why was it a test? And I thought this was my question. Today I saw that the Rishonim already asked the question, the Bali Atosfos, and many of the Achronim asked the question too. So it's a question ring that's asked by many more people than me. What?
Which one?
Which Stasemis asked the question?
Which was the test? Which one?
Oh, the one, Lech Lecha. The question is the following. Rashi says, Lech Lecha. Why don't you say Lech? What's Lech Lecha? Lecha means Lehanoscha Uletovoscha. For your pleasure and your good. Now let's first discuss what that means. Pleasure means there are things in this world that are pleasurable, but they're not good for you. Okay? Plenty of things. We don't have to go into detail. There are a lot of things that are pleasurable, they're not good for you. And there are many things in this world that are good for you, but they're not pleasurable. when my mother, Aleha Shalom, used to say, eat your vegetables, they're good for you, I knew they didn't taste good. Because if they did, she wouldn't have to resort to telling me how good they were for me. So there are a lot of things that are good for you, they're not pleasurable. And there are a lot of things that are pleasurable, and they're not good for you. HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises Avraham Avinu, if you make this move to Eretz Yisrael, I promise you, it's going to be pleasurable and good for you. Both. I think that that is exactly what Kalev and Yoshua meant when they described Eretz Yisrael, when they came back with the other spies, and they praised Eretz Yisrael. They said, Tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od. The land is very, very good. Now what does that mean? How much more good is that than one very and less than three berries? What does that mean, very, very good? How do you explain it? I think what it means is the following. In Shema, we say, V'yohavtos Hashem Elokecha, v'chol levavcha, uv'chol nafshecha, uv'chol me'odecha, with all your ma'od. The rabbis have two explanations of what that means. One is, v'chol ma'odcha, with all your material possessions. Serve God with all your material possessions. The second meaning is, v'chol mido mido shumodivcha, whatever measure God measures out to you, what appears to you good or bad, praise Him for it because it's all for your good. Even what appears to be bad is ultimately gamzu v'tov, it's for your good. I think that's what they meant. Tova ha'aretz. Eretz Yisrael is good in both connotations. Ma'od, ma'od. It's good for you in your material possessions. It's good, it's pleasurable, and it's good for you. Even if it appears to be bad, it's good for you. So it has both connotations. It's good for you, and it's pleasurable. That's ma'od, ma'od, both ma'ods. In any case, if God came to any of us, and we know for sure it was God, okay, we're not talking now about a shaliach aliyah who promises you that if you go to Eretz Yisrael, it's going to be good and pleasurable. Okay, that does not count. Okay, God comes and He says, I promise you, you make the move to Timbuktu, I promise you it's going to be for your good and your pleasure. Where's the test? Why wouldn't we go? Of course you go. You have a promise from God that making this move will be good and pleasurable. Why not go? So where's the test? The test of Avraham Avinu, right, to go to Eretz Yisrael, promise that it's going to be good and pleasurable. Where's the test? That's the question. So let me tell you what I think. It's hard for me to say over what I'm going to tell you, because today I thought of a new answer to this, which I'm going to say on Shabbos as my drasha, and I have that pounding in my head, so this one now became in the background. But I'd rather tell you this one. Yeah.
Do you have anything to do with leaving this false
prophet
behind Terah?
Yes and no, but still, God said, this is what you have to do. It's the right thing to do, right? This is where you're going to be successful. If you stay here, you're not. So then, and God Himself said, don't worry about your father. I'm exempting you from Kibbutz Avayim. So, what's the problem with
it? Because he was the epitome of chesed. It doesn't sound like a very chesedy thing to do to leave your poor old father behind and just go.
I hear. But Avram's chesed was based on what is chesed according to God. And if God told him, look, this is what you should do, this is the right thing to do, then that becomes the chesed. Leave. And not only that, he was told not to take him with him. Leave him here, don't take him with you. That's what's the right thing to do. Chesed isn't what you feel is right. It's what is right. And if God tells you it's right, it's right.
It's parallel to the Akedah
Yitzchak. I hear. Okay,
God
maybe.
God said to him, do it, even though it's the most cruel thing.
I hear. Even though he was promised for him, it'll be fine. Leaving his father may have been the test. Maybe. Could be. Tell you another answer. I have another answer besides that, but I'm not going to tell you that one. I'll tell you the answer to the problem. In order to understand this, I'm going to start with another question, another few questions. And eventually we'll answer all of them and get back to this. Before we come to Eretz Yisrael, the Torah says the following. Ha'aretz asher ani mevi eschem shama lo ke'eretz Mitzrayim. The land I'm bringing you to is not like the land of Egypt. Because in Egypt you always had a readily available water supply, the Nile. It overflowed by cycle, and you always had water, which you could then dig furrows and irrigate your fields. No problem. It's just a matter of bringing the water to where you needed it. But there's always was a plentiful supply of water for irrigation and drinking. But the land I'm bringing you to is a land of hills and mountains. Limtar hashamayim tishdemayim. There is no ready irrigation in Eretz Yisrael. Everything depends on rain. If it rains, tonight we're going to ask for rain, and rain is mainly for Eretz Yisrael. Everything else is, the rest of the world is just the leftovers from Eretz Yisrael. But everything starts here. So we're going to ask for rain, and it's important. We know how important it is. We know that when the years that it doesn't rain that much, it's dangerous. There's not a food water supply. We don't have water for anything extra, whatever, and it's an emergency situation. So the land I'm bringing to you is not like Eretz Mitzrayim. There you always had a plentiful water supply. In Eretz Israel, you don't have a plentiful water supply. Everything depends on rainfall, and it doesn't always rain. Now, I don't know, but God doesn't sound like a great salesman. He's trying to sell us in Eretz Israel, right? I think he's telling the people, you know, why don't you just go back to Egypt? That's what the message I would get. What's God trying to do? Like, downplay the greatness of Eretz Israel and emphasize how great Mitzrayim was? Obviously, it's not the intention. So what is the intention? Another question, similar. The Nachash, the original snake, got a few curses. One of the curses the snake got was, V'ofer tochal kol yemechayecha. You will eat dust all of your life. Now, one interpretation of that is that whatever the snake eats tastes like dust. It doesn't mean that snakes eat dust, because dust is not nutritious. Snakes could not live on dust. So don't eat dust. They eat rats, mice, right? Plants, they don't eat dust. So what does it mean, you'll eat dust? It means whatever you eat will taste like dust. That's a curse. No taste, everything is bland like dust. There's another interpretation. That interpretation is, wherever you go, your food supply will be available to you as the dust of the earth. Just like there's dust everywhere, your food supply will be readily available to you wherever you go. Now, I don't know, but I don't think that's a curse. I wouldn't mind a curse like that. Wherever you go, wake up in the morning, don't have to go shopping, open the refrigerator, it's full. Your food supply will be like the dust of the earth, always available to you. Why is that a curse? In addition to that, converse, in the Midbar we got a bracha. We got the mon. How many days supply of the mon did we have? One day. If you tried to save it for the next day except for Shabbos, it rotted, got wormy. That means every Jew started out in the morning with the cupboards bare. Like old Mother Hubbard. There was nothing, unless the man fell. So, that's a bracha. Couldn't God give us like a week's supply, a month's supply? Why every day you had to have this feeling, there's nothing in the house, you got to wait for the man to fall. It's a bracha not to have a lot of food, and it's a klala to have a lot of food. Why? I never understood this. Until the following Maisa, true episode happened, and from this episode I understood it. I've said this here before, but there are new faces here that haven't heard it yet, and if you've heard it before, you haven't heard it from me more times than I heard it from you. So don't worry. It's a real true story. Okay. In fact, the one who the story is about is going to soon be one of our Nechutonim. Okay. My son is getting married to their granddaughter, and that is Mrs. Goldsmith. Okay, Mrs. Nemtsov knows who she is. She taught Hebrew in the high school, public high school in Miami. Hebrew then was a recognized second language in the public high school system in Miami. Now the recognized second language in Miami is English. Spanish is the first language. In any case, so she taught Hebrew, and she obviously had a lot of Jews in her class. She called me one day and she said, Rabbi, I have a student, a 17-year-old boy in one of my Hebrew classes, and he's already tried to commit suicide twice unsuccessfully, and we're afraid he's going to try again, and this time he'll be successful, and no one has been able to get through to him to try to convince him that it's worth going on with his life. Maybe you'd like to try to save a Yiddish neshama. So can I bring him in and see what you can do? Is it fine? So she brought this boy in, walks into my office. I never saw a sadder, more depressed looking human being in my life. The kid looked like the world had come to an end, and he knew about it, but I didn't. That's how bad it was. So I said to him, you know, you're only 17 years old. What could have happened in your short life that makes you so sad and depressed? He said, Rabbi, I'll tell you. He said, I've grown up my 17 years with my father alone. My mother abandoned us when I was an infant. I don't even know who she is. Never met her. She never bothered to contact me. I don't know. I know I had a mother. I have no idea who she was. I've grown up with my father. My father is a very wealthy man. And I surmise from what has occurred in the last few weeks that this is what happened. My father has met a woman that he wants to marry. But the woman has made a condition of marrying him that I'm not in the picture. She doesn't want a teenager cramping her style. So my father called me in a few weeks ago, and out of his right pocket he took a set of keys. And he said, these are keys to a very plush condominium that I bought you in a very yuppie neighborhood in Miami. Fully furnished, fully paid for. It's yours. Enjoy it. He gave me the keys. From his left pocket, he took another set of keys. So these are keys to a very fancy sports car, fully paid for. You need transportation. It's your car. He gave me the keys. From his wallet, he took out a credit card on his name. He said, look, you need clothing, food, entertainment. Within reason, I'm a wealthy man. Within reason, put it on my credit card. I'll pay the bill. Gave me the credit card. He said, just one thing. Don't call me. Don't come and visit me. This is it. It's nice knowing you. Have a nice life. Goodbye. That was it. Now, I was much younger at the time. Much younger. And I thought to myself, if I was 17 years old and I had my own apartment, my own sports car, and unlimited credit, I don't think I'd be suicidal. I think I'd be pretty happy. So my first reaction was to tell this kid, or to want to tell him, I didn't say this. I said, you know, everybody in this world has their peckle of tzaras, their package of problems. You have yours, your apartment, your car, and your credit card. I have mine. Let's switch. You give me your tzaras, your credit card, your apartment, your car, I'll give you my tzaras. But then I realized that every time this kid lived in that apartment, every time he used that car or the credit card, it reminded him that nobody wanted it, that he was totally rejected, unloved by anyone. That's a curse. That's the curse of the snake. The Rabbanu Shlom says there has to be snakes, but I don't want anything to do with you. So I'm giving you your food supply till the end of time, but I don't have any relationship with you. That's a curse. The Jewish people only had one day's food supply. You know why? Because God wanted them to know that every single day they have a Father in heaven who cares for them and will provide them with food. That's a blessing. Not the same amount of food, but a relationship with the Rabbanu Shalom. That's a blessing. That's the difference between Mitzrayim and Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael doesn't have as much water, but it gets its water supply directly from God. And you know that you have a relationship. Sometimes he'll hold back the water because you're not good. Sometimes he'll give it to you. But you know that God cares. The next sentence in the Torah, in that, right after that sentence about the Eretz Yisrael not having a readily available water supply, and everything depends on rain, is Eretz Asher Einei Hashem Elokecha Ba Mereshis Hashana V'Arach Rishon. It's a land where God's eyes are on that land from beginning to the end of the year. You have a special, close relationship with God. You may not have as much water, but that's a bracha. Mitzrayim, God said, look, Mitzrayim has to have water. I don't want anything to do with that. So I'm going to put them on a Shabbos clock called the Nile. It will overflow by cycle. They'll have their water supply. I don't want to be involved. I don't want to have a relationship with them. That's a curse. That's what it says. Eretz Yisrael, you have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch. And Eretz Mitzrayim, you don't. It says in the Torah, Re'ei Anochi Nosin Lefnechem Hayom Bracha Uklo. See, think. Re'ei means not to see with your eyes, it means to think with your mind. Ponder. Think deeply. Contemplate. I'm giving you blessing and curse. What should I contemplate? Blessing is blessing, curse is a curse. Who would want to choose the curse? The answer is that you need to have the right value system to know what a curse is and what a blessing is. Because if you don't, you could see the curse as a blessing and the blessing is a curse. If your value system is food, then what the Nachash got was a blessing and what the Jewish people got was a curse. If your value system is a relationship with God, then the Jews got a bracha and the Nachash got a cloth. So it's not so simple. What is good and pleasurable? It depends on your system, your value system. That was the Nesaya of Lech Lecha. God said, I promise you that going to Eretz Yisrael will be good and pleasurable with one condition, that you get your head on straight and you know what's a curse and what's a blessing, what's good and what's pleasurable. Because if you don't have the right value system, right, then you may not see that Eretz Yisrael is good and pleasurable. To you it may be horrendous. It may be a terror, a nightmare, which unfortunately is to some people if they don't have the right values, if they don't know how to look at it properly. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want Avraham Avinu just to make a geographic change of location. But he wanted him to make a change in his whole outlook on life and adapt it to what Eretz Yisrael is all about. How do I know that? Because it says, Lech lecha me'artzecha, from your land, umimoladetecha, from your birthplace, umiveis avicha, from your father's home. The Chorin should be just the opposite. We're talking about physical moving away from these places. First you leave your father's home, then you leave your birthplace, the city where you're born, then you leave the country. Not the opposite order, which is what the Torah said. The answer is, we're not talking about leaving physically. We're talking about getting yourself away from the ideas, philosophies, values of your country in general, which is less influencing, your city of birth even more influencing, your father's home even more influencing. Get away from all of those and get your perspective, get your values, right, your perspective on life fit to what's going to be in Eretz Yisrael. That answers another question.
Don't have a chumash here, but without the chumash, it's better to see it inside the chumash.
Hey, they took away that book.
Yeah.
That's exactly, to a certain degree, that's exactly the point.
Okay.
Because those things, Eretz Yisrael's nikness be suited. What appears on the surface not to be pleasurable or good, but in the long run is the way to acquire that. Right.
That's
not all the time. Right. Okay. Listen to the psuk. God tells Abraham, pick yourself up, go to the land that I will show you. Then it says, Vayelech Avram. So he went. Not only did Avram go, Vayelech Itolo, Lot went with him. The Avram ben Chomei Shonim v'Shigim Shana b'Seisom Mecharon. And Avram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Next pasuk. Vayikach Avram esorei yishto v'es Lot ben Achiv v'es Korichu shom asher achoshu v'es hanefesh asher asu b'Haran v'yeitzu l'leches arzu kenan v'yavo arzu kenan. Avram took his wife Sarai and Lot and all the students and all the possessions, and he left to go to Eretz Canaan, and they got to Eretz Canaan. He left already. Why two sentences say the same thing? The first sentence says he went. Second sentence says he took Sarai and he went. How many times did he go? You can't say, perhaps, the first time Avram left with Lot. They're on the road, and Avram turns to Lot and he says, we forgot something. I can't put my finger on it, but there's something we forgot. We turned the electricity off, or... one second, let's just close this. Right? And then it hits him. Ah, we forgot Sarah. So they run back. That can't be what it means. So what does it mean? Why does it say that he left twice? So I think it could mean the following. There are other interpretations, other answers to this question. What I think it means is the following. And I found that the Zohar says similar to what I'm saying, at least in the second pasuk. Avram went. What does Avram went mean? It means he took his wife. Avram and Sarai are one. Doesn't have to mention that his wife went. If Avram went, his wife and him are one. They went together. Doesn't have to say he took his students. A student is like a child. Took his children. Doesn't have to say he took his money and his possessions. Of course he took his money and his possessions. All of that is included. What's not included? Lot. He didn't have to take his nephew. He's not part of him. So it says, and Lot also went. Avram and everything that is included in Avram, Sarai, his students, his money, went. And also Lot went. That's it. They went. That's talking about physically leaving. The next sentence tells me something completely different. The Rashi, Chazal say this. Whenever it says in the Torah, kach, vayikach, by a human being, take, it doesn't mean to take him by the hand. It means to convince. To convince them. Because you can't take a human being by the hand, you're just taking his body. Take a human being means convince them. So you take their neshama, take their intellect. For instance, back in Parshas Bereishis, Vayikach Elo Shem Elokim Es Ha'adam, and he put him in Gan Eden. He convinced him that it was beneficial for him to be in Gan Eden. Kochenu Bidvorim, Kach Es Aaron, take him. Doesn't mean take him by the hand, it means convince him. Kach Es Alevim, and so on, and so on, and so on. All throughout the Torah, whenever it says Vayikach, Kach, by a human being, it means to convince. They're on the road, all of them. And Avraham Avinu gathers them all together and he says, you know, God does not only want us to make a change of location from Chutz La'aretz to Eretz Israel. He wants us to totally redefine our values, what's important in life, in order that when we get to Eretz Israel, we'll appreciate that it's for our good and our pleasure. So Vayikach Avraham es Sarai Ishto. He now convinced them, spoke to them about how to prepare themselves mentally for coming to Eretz Israel, so they'll appreciate what the bracha is, and that was the test. And that's why it says, "Vayikach Avram esorei ishto v'yeslot benochi," and the rechusham asher rachashu, all the material possessions. Now they had to see in a different light, and his students the same thing. So here, the vayikach doesn't mean he took them and what's it called physically. They already were on the way physically. But now, mentally, they made that exit from Chutz La'aretz, mentally, to enter Eretz Yisrael with a different perspective, with a different value system, with a different look at life, in order that what God promised him, that Eretz Yisrael would be good and pleasurable, he would recognize it by having the right value system. Okay. Let's go to something else. Any questions on this? If not, I really want to speak about something else. We don't have that much time. Because you're going to sit in shul and hear the laney, and you may look over and see what it says, and the women are going to be very bothered. And the men, possibly also a little bit. What does it say? They come to Eretz Yisrael, and there's a famine. Huh? What? What? Right. Let me make it how serious. Okay, now it won't after I finish it.
Our grandson is going to lane.
Okay, so he's going to lane the following. Avram has to go down to Egypt because of what's it called, the famine. Takes a look at his wife and he says, "We got a problem here. You are extremely beautiful, and these Egyptians are lecherous people. They're going to see you. They're going to want you. They're going to kill me, your husband, and they're going to take you. We got to solve this problem. Very big problem." Avram says, "I got a great idea. Say you're my sister. That way, they won't kill me. They'll give me presents to try to win your hand. So, they'll take you. But I'll live." Right? I'll live because what you're saying, you're my sister. And not only that, vayitivli, they'll give me presents. So I'm going to really gain from this.
Yeah, so we're
right. Exactly. Right. But you, okay, you know, can't solve all the problems. Right? So, right. But it solves one part of the problem. I'm taken care of. That's Avraham Avinu. Right? she's still going to be taken, right? But they're not going to kill him, just the opposite. They'll give him presents. So everything pretty much is okay now, except Nebuch, you know, you'll have to be taken. But, you know, we solved the main thing over here, me. That's Avraham Avinu. What's going on over here? Not only that, later on in next week's session, Avraham tells us, does it again with Avimelech, and again it fails. And he says, everywhere we went, we always did this. I mean, Avraham Avinu, like, this is natural, right?
Yeah,
Yitzchak also does it. What's going on? So let me tell you, a combination of various mefarshim, each one a little extra thing, putting them all together, it really explains what's going on. Avraham Avinu realized that these people are not totally a hefker. They're not, you know, what's it called, headhunters. They're basically civilized people who try to keep the seven mitzvahs of Noah. They don't murder, they don't steal, they don't commit adultery, basically. Except that when they can't get what they want in a permissible way, they don't give up and they'll do it prohibited. Now, as long as we can do it permissible, we'll do it permissible, right? But if we can't, then we'll get what we want, even if it's prohibited. That's the kind of people we're talking about. So Avraham Avinu said, they're going to want you, and they're not going to give in. They're going to get you, one way or another. Now, if you're a married woman, they have a choice. The choice that they're going to hold themselves back and not take you is not a choice. So they have two choices. There's two prohibitions over here, adultery and murder. Either they're going to murder me, and then there's no more adultery, or they're going to take you and commit adultery and not commit murder. Which will they choose? Says Avraham Avinu, the option of not taking you doesn't exist. The only way they can get you is either adultery or murder. They choose the murder over the adultery. Why? Because murder is a one-time thing. And then they'll do tshuva, you know, one time to get it behind them. But if they don't murder me and they take you, every time they live with you, it's adultery. It's a sin every single time. They're not getting over it. They can't put it behind them. So they'll choose to murder me and then to take you, and it won't be adultery. They'll be over one aveira of murder, one time thing. On the other hand, if you say you're my sister, okay, now they can take you beheter completely, permissibly. They don't have to take you forcibly because you're an unmarried woman. Okay?
In their mind,
right? You're an unmarried woman. So what are they going to do? They're not going to take you forcibly because they don't do things in a prohibited way if they can do it permissibly. What will they try to do? Court you. And since I'm the only relative around, what was the custom? That the brother was in place of the father. So they'll come to ask me for your hand in marriage. I won't give up so fast. I'll say, well, what do you have to offer? And so some of them that will discourage, right? Some of them will say, I have a lot to offer. They'll offer me, and I say, well, you know, it's a nice offer, but I'd like to wait to see if I can get more. So I'll stall. And eventually the famine will be over, and one night we will get out of here, hightail it out of here, and we'll both be fine. That was the intention. Avraham Avinu said, if I don't give them the need to have to take you by force, if it's possible they can get you in a permissible way, they'll do that. They think that you're unmarried and I'm your brother, then they will come and court you and ask me for your hand in marriage. And I will stall. They'll give me presents. And I'll stall. And in the end, we'll both be fine. That was the Hishtadlus. And it worked every single time except two. And the only two times the Torah tells us about it is the two times it didn't work. Why? Because it worked with everybody except the king. Because the king didn't have to court her or ask the brother for permission. If she's an unmarried woman, like Ahasuerush, the king took her. So that Avraham Avinu didn't factor into the equation. And two times the king took her. But every other time, it worked. Because the people vied for her, and they stalled, and by the time, the people got wind of what was going on, they were gone to the next place. So it did work.
Excuse me, who were the two? One was the Esther.
What?
Who were the two?
The two, Avimelech and Paro.
I have a question. Abraham Avinu brought the whole thing in the first place by not going down to Mitzrayim. He wasn't told to go down. It was a family land. He had not go down to Mitzrayim because of the family in his day. He was waiting for God to tell him what to do and not rush down to Mitzrayim.
Okay. The Pirkei Avos says that Avraham Avinu had 10 tests and he passed all of them. And this was one of them, the Rav. So it's mashma that he did the right thing. However, the Ramban, and it seems from the Zohar similarly, say that Avraham Avinu did something wrong. He put his wife in danger. He should not have gone to Egypt. Should not have gone to Egypt. And because of that, it left a bad blemish on the Jewish people that in the end they went down to Egypt and the same thing happened to them. Right? God had to bring Negoyim on them or whatever, same kind of thing. And they wanted to take the women and kill the men. Exactly the same thing.
Punishment for that.
Punishment for that. It's very difficult though, because it says in Pirkei Avos that Avraham Avinu passed all his tests. According to this, he didn't pass the test. The answer, I think, is the following. I really had that down to say and I crossed it out. But so I'll just say. What I think is the following. The test was not if Avram would go to Mitzrayim or not. The test wasn't if he would leave Eretz Israel. If there's a famine and you have nothing to eat, then you have to do a shtadlus. You can't stay where you are. You have to go find a place to eat. So the fact that he left Eretz Israel was what he should have done. What was the test? Would he complain? Hey God, you told me this is for my good, my pleasure. I come to this land and there's a famine in this land, nowhere else. What are you doing to me? This is the good and pleasurable land you sent me to. Could have complained. He did. He accepted it. God, in the long run, this is probably for my good and it'll be pleasure. So there's no problem of his leaving Eretz Israel, and he passed the test, he didn't complain about it. You know where the problem was? Why did you go to Mitzrayim? You could have gone somewhere else. Mitzrayim was known to be a place of danger spiritually. You left a physical danger and put yourself into a spiritual danger. If you're already considering a physical danger, something worth making your shtadlus to avoid, why don't you see a spiritual danger to be the same thing? God didn't tell him to go to Mitzrayim. He chose that place to go. He could have gone somewhere else. Why were you willing to put yourself into spiritual danger if you understood that you're supposed to get yourself out of physical danger? Then how could you put yourself into spiritual danger? That was the problem. The problem wasn't leaving Eretz Israel. The problem was not, and then he didn't complain about it, but he should have chosen somewhere else to go. Or he should have said, look, I have a dilemma here. If I go to Mitzrayim, I'm putting myself and my wife in spiritual danger. If I stay in Eretz Israel, I'm putting myself in physical danger. Which is worse? Spiritual danger is much worse than physical danger. Stay where you are. So, in some respect, he passed the test. He left Eretz Israel, no problem. He didn't complain about it. But in one respect, he did something wrong by choosing to go to Mitzrayim. The test was not, would he go to Mitzrayim or not? The test was, would he complain about leaving Eretz Israel? But he introduced another factor which wasn't part of the thing at all, and that's where he did something wrong. Why did you go to Egypt? Could have gone somewhere else. Don't put yourself in spiritual danger if you understand how important it is to avoid physical danger. That's the idea. So both are true. Passed the test, at the same time he did something wrong.
Okay.
Maybe he did, and God didn't answer. Right? I've asked Hashem many times. So far he hasn't answered. Right? So maybe that was part of the test. Right? God, you're there when you tell me where to go, right? And now I want to know what to do, and you're not there. And that's very possible. And Avraham Avinu had to function according to what he thought was right to do based on his knowledge of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he chose the right thing. Except he didn't make the right choice of where to go in the end. That's all. The Ribbono Shel Olam leaves people to their free choice. And that's part of what life is. God doesn't direct you in every single thing. He gives you general and you have to make the choices. That was a test. What? Could be, yeah. I mean, he could have gone back to Aram Narayan for temporary or whatever. He knew of other countries for sure. Okay. 2 weeks in your session. Yeah, so you asked me to bring them. How many do you want? One?
I'll take one.
Good.
Rabbi, can you tell me what happened to the young man?
Yes. Oh, I was waiting for a question that. The young man, after I looked into it, was adopted. He wasn't even the man's real son. And he was a Catholic. So I called the Catholic services in Miami, and they found him a very nice foster home. When I left Miami, about 2-3 years later, I checked up on him. And I found that he was very happy in the foster home, and he still had his apartment and his credit card and his car, so he had the best of both worlds. Then he was already okay. He wasn't committing suicide anymore.
Okay, how much is it?
110 shekel. That's 10 shekel less than you get in the bookstore.
Okay.
If you want me to, I would be happy to. Yeah, it doesn't take off the price, though.
I have the other one. By the way, I want you to know there's another book I use. It's the third year now. The first time.
You want an English, Hebrew?
Whichever way you want to write.
And Sandy is in Hebrew.
I don't know. It's
Sarah.
Sorry,
Gaffa? And your husband's name?
Is that the book you're working on, Rabbi?
What?
Is that the book you're working on all these years?
Yes.
There's something else.
Yeah, this is one of them. I have another one that should be finished. It should be coming out maybe by Pesach.
Yeah, what's it about?
About the Yom Tov.
There
must be a lot of people giving you books to look over manuscripts and stuff.
Write a check. Yeah, the kids.
Just pick it up.
Is it okay? Is the check okay?
To whom?
Harry and Maxine.
I don't have any. I didn't see
them. In English?
I didn't bring them.
I asked you once if you were related to him or something.
Yeah, my brother. I tell him we got it.
Yeah.
Back to the Irish.
I'm going to try and finish that later.
Okay.
And,
I have to later on.
They send me things sometimes.
Matisse,
you said the 18th. What day is the Tuesday? Is that the
Rabbi Leff, where else could we obtain the book?
In what's it called? I know they have it by Feldheim in Yerushalayim.
Oh,
I'm here in Netanya. I don't know where the bookstore is. There's a bookstore here?
They don't have any English books here.
No, they don't have English books.
They have it at Maria. I saw it at Maria in the old city.
No, we won't be here. We're going to Eilat with the shul.
Then 2 weeks?
In Yeshua. Oh. Yeah. David's brother's coming from us.
And I would just say, you know, she was helping a fellow shekel donation for the shoe.
Oh, thank you.
Just to read.
Thank you very much.
Right, maybe I'll get the money to somebody next week.
Fine, just say we want to. I trust you.
Yeah.
I know you for a while.
Yeah, for a while. All right, thank you. Because I know David was on
it. Here's the book.
All right, so I'll leave the money with somebody for you. Thank you. That looks very nice. Nice to meet you. Public.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
You have to write some.
Write many more books.
See, I was concerned when I put out the book.